Okay, it's lovely to see you all here. Do feel free to snooze at any point without feeling that pain, because I know it's amazing to have had a day's work and then come out. I'm going to do quite a formal paper rather than an informal talk, because what I want to talk about is so complicated it's difficult for me at this stage of the day also to hold it in my head. And I was going to start off with an almost silent preface, because I'm into this new idea of silent lectures. Great relief for those who don't like voices droning on. But since this is being recorded, I'm afraid I'm going to have to make it, in fact, a less than silent preface, just to make sure that everybody who's not here gets the sound. As Dawn mentioned, one of the things I'm doing here is not self-promotion, but giving a place in the world to A Labour of Love, which is a book that I've written. It came out in 2013. And this is one of the epigraphs to the book. Artists continually introduce into culture all sorts of Trojan horses from the margins of their consciousness. In that way, the limits of the symbolic are transgressed all the time by art. It's quite possible that many work products carry subjective traces of their creators. But the specificity of works of art is that their materiality cannot be detached from ideas, perceptions, emotions, consciousness, cultural meanings, etc. And that being interpreted and reinterpreted is their cultural destiny. This is one of the reasons why works of art are symbologenic. And this epigraph is by Bracha Ettinger. This is the sentence that follows to the opening of my book. In writing this book about trauma and aesthetic practice, I arrived at the following question. Do artists affected by or obligated to haunting pasts journey away from or towards an encounter with traumatic residues? The artist in question may be personally burdened by politically caused horrific historical experiences, or by secrets, shame, guilt, morbidity, bereavement, exile, abuse. Some artists are additionally sensitized by personal affliction to the calamities of the undoubtedly catastrophic dimensions of imperial, fascist, colonial and post-colonial modernity, and the extreme suffering of others vicariously transmitted to us by mediatized information systems. And this led me to more questions. Can aesthetic practices, what I'm calling the creation of afterimages, bring about transformation, and that does not mean cure or resolution, of trauma, personal or historical, inhabiting the world that artists also process as participants in and sensors for our life worlds and our troubled histories? What modes of reading aesthetic practices might be mobilized to answer such questions? So that was the project of one book. But I'm also going to introduce tonight a second book which has a closer relationship to the Freud Museum. The book is published in 2013. The installation, however, happened in 2009, and the book is, as you can see, back to front and double. And this book opens with this epigraph from the same person who wrote the epigraph for the other one. In the beginning I painted, then I thought I should not make a profession from that which is most hidden, the most non-social and the most non-institutional. I had to hide it, not make art my professional work, and study something else. So I studied and worked as a clinical psychologist. But what I pushed underground and left behind continually haunted me. When I came to Paris, I left everything of my life in Tel Aviv and my work in the psychiatric hospital in order to paint. I painted and I stopped being a psychologist. But then again, slowly, what I left behind haunted me. I was first painting, and then not painting. And then I started painting again until I slowly began to integrate the notes and the thinking, the painting and life, this work and that profession, psychoanalytical theory and practice, writing and painting. And it took me years to understand that this was all part of an artistic oeuvre, which is mine. But when I transferred my artistic experience with pigment, dust, colour, ash, lines and grains to my theoretical knowledge and practice, I wrote in a psychoanalytical language because it was the only language I had, the only theoretical world at my disposition. At the same time, I discovered with anguish its poverty in the domains of the art and of the feminine. What came from my art allowed me to understand what goes on with my patients, but something also began to work the other way round. You see where that quotation comes from. So then I wrote of that, "This beautiful narrative is an account of how one person can exist so fully inside two worlds, art and psychoanalysis. The one is neither applied to nor illustrated by the other, nor does either explain its other. What terms do we have to capture this movement between a mute world of making, pigment, dust, colour, ash, lines and grains, and the word-rich acoustic communicative spaces of analysis, and beyond both, the domains of thought and theoretical writing? Is this a case of mutual haunting, or of a form of co-emergence that we have not yet known? Freud, as you know, collected antiquities. Lacan had his own collection of art. Artists have undertaken analysis. Analysts have theorized creativity. Bracha Ettinger tells us, however, that she inhabits both spheres in a constant movement that enables art to be a source of knowledge in its own right. Through its processes, her painting enriches analytical tradition and practice, while the process of listening to the anguish of analysands throws new light on what is tipping into the visible and the knowable through art, from the space where proto-psychic events are to be understood as aesthetic, breathing, sensing, movement, rhythm, pulsation, and resonance. For decades we have struggled with relations between art and thought as if these were distinct, defined, even opposed fields. Bracha Ettinger's co-inhabitation of two practices, art and psychoanalysis, is also a co-inhabitation of two spheres of thinking about those aspects of subjectivity in its worlds that are not entirely managed by the rational and the cognitive modes we define as thinking. One can claim that art thinks, that art is a form of thought, or even that art can be a form of research. But at the same time, we risk demanding of art the sublimation of its specific links with the proto-subjective, the processes of human becoming, and with the aesthetic that are intimately bonded with the aesthetic dimension. Seeing this double movement of art towards thought and thought towards the aesthetic at work is very rare, and I have just chosen to write about one instance. So now we really have the talk. When you finish writing a book, you abandon the world in which you lived while writing it. There between the covers is now deposited the product of the long time spent in intense conversation with the materials about which the book is purportedly being written. But books emerge from that encounter, often taking unexpected turns, arriving at destinations not anticipated. For some years now, I have been absorbed in the aesthetics of trauma. I found that I had accumulated a set of encounters with artworks and with the lifelong artistic practices of several artists that shared a relation to trauma and to artistic inventions of modes or forms for, well, that was the question, for what? Processing, inscribing, hiding from, making visible, or ultimately encountering the traces of trauma. So, as I've said, the key question at which I unexpectedly arrived in my book came out as this. Do artists travel away from or towards the traces of trauma? This would shift the question from either the intentionality of the artist or the representation of some kind of traumatic content. I discovered that trauma was never on their minds, but it was certainly in their hands. It returned in strange an unformulated pressure, shaping practices that acquired an effective and ultimately formal, material, rhythmic, even acoustic forms from this unsayable, unseen, shapeless psychological phenomenon for which psychology has appropriated a violent medical concept, trauma, which means a piercing wound. I also found that the risk of re-encountering these traumatic residues, such that they might take shape as knowledge, could be potentially deadly, as seems to be the case of the philosopher Sara Kaufman, who did not survive the writing of her book about her childhood as a hidden Jewish child in Paris. So I began to ask myself what aesthetic and psychic economies facilitate what Rucker Ettinger named as art as the transport station of trauma. Could the study of artistic practices and the transformation or its failure of trauma have something to offer psychoanalysis as both practice and theory? Side by side with the study of works by Louis Bourgeois, such as Maman, Anna Mendieta, Anna Maria Maialino, Alina Shapochnikov, whom I'm very grateful to two members of the audience here for introducing me, Vera Frankl, Sarah Kaufman herself, and Chantal Ackerman. So side by side with the study of these works, I have written an art historical encounter between Rucker Ettinger, the artist, and this time-space of memory migration that is the Freud Museum in London, where I had curated a show of Ettinger's work in June-July 2009. In fact, of course, I did no such thing. I simply created the occasion for an event encounter between Sigmund and Anna Freud, the key figures in the first and second generations of psychoanalysis, and what we could call a fourth-generation psychoanalyst and a second-generation artist, who could encounter their space on the other end of the string of historical catastrophe that brought the Freuds to Maresfield Gardens and led the woman Rucker Ettinger to be born to Polish Jewish survivors of the Holocaust in the newly created state of Israel in the year of its birth. A third book, an edited collection, has also come out, in which I included a chapter written by me about the dual aftermath of that event, the mutual trauma of Israel-Palestine, and the need for feminist theories, philosophical and psychoanalytical, with which to confront what Adriana Caballero, an Italian philosopher, names the dominant crime of our times, not terrorism, but horrorism, which is violence against the vulnerable. And these last two books seek to think about psychoanalysis in the spirit in which Freud's last work was written, Moses and Monotheism, under the terrible anxiety of his own imminent death from cancer and from the menace of a genocidal fascism. And in that book he asked, what does history ask of psychoanalytical thinking, and what insights can psychoanalytical thinking offer to the study of history? Freud writing on Moses is, in fact, for many of us, the key book for the study of trauma as a cultural inscription and a cultural transformation of its subjects. In the installation, and writing about the installation by Rucker Ettinger, I placed Ettinger at the other end of a string of the historical moment that brought Freud and Anna and Sigmund and the rest of their family to London, being born into the legacy of its aftermath in ways that make her, as a peace-oriented and dissident Israeli, constantly aware of the continuing trauma that her existence of her own state itself causes. Now, just over a month ago, I had a wonderful opportunity to talk about my new book on trauma and aesthetic transformation, which I've briefly sketched for you, at the Whitechapel Art Gallery with two brilliant readers, Adrian Rifkin and Jacqueline Rose. Perhaps one of the most renowned and distinguished feminist cultural thinkers who has adamantly and creatively insisted on the importance and value of psychoanalysis in the cultural field of literary and political analysis, Jacqueline Rose liked my book as art history, but did not agree at all with its theoretical foundations in Ettingerian or matrixial theory. She declared openly that she did remain loyal to the Kleinian vision, particularly with regard to the relations or the formation of subjectivity in relation to the mother and child. So this led me to another question. What determines our attachments to certain theories of subjectivity, namely theories of who and what we are? Surely this too is a psychoanalytical question. Now, I was not at all surprised by this clear difference in our theoretical orientations, as each of us finds our theoretical nourishment and personal understanding in different parts of the now expanded and complex field of psychoanalysis. But not only are these matters of personal proclivities, I think also, however, there is a politics at stake. At one stage, Lacan ruled the theoretical roost in cultural studies alongside a revisioned Freud. Then there was a new renewed re-engagement with Melanie Klein's work, which has served both literary theorists such as Dr. Rose and Mary Jacobus and art historians such as Mignon Nixon in their studies of mother-daughter relations, or mother-father relations in the notion of Louise Bourgeois. The work of Julia Kristeva on the borderlines of literature, language and psychoanalysis has also become part of our academic canon. And through the meeting of philosophy and psychoanalysis, Lucy Rigaray postulates a recognized need for the recognition of sexual difference, forming a now major trend in feminist philosophy taken up by Australians such as Elizabeth Gross and other feminists, who are prepared to investigate the utopian dimension of femininity as that which is not yet known. So the feminist critique of the phallocentric, and even the acknowledgement of the possibility of sexual difference as other than the construction of the phallic monosexual regime, has been well established. Now, the moment for me was in 1992, when I was introduced to a Paris-based artist called Bracha Ettinger, who had just given a lecture to a German Feminist Art Historians Congress in Hamburg, drawing into a theoretical formulation the insights that she had jotted down in her notebooks after each day's painting, as well as during her analytical sessions. I published this foundational argument in an American feminist journal of cultural studies called Differences in 1992 as part of a themed issue titled Trouble in the Archives. Differences was edited by Naomi Shaw, a brilliant American feminist scholar already concerned by the new turn in feminist studies in the early 90s towards what has become the dominant tendency precipitated by Judith Butler's book Gender Trouble. Even though Butler has herself increasingly recognized psychoanalysis as a necessary foundation for her desire to think about countering heteronormative dominance and also making critiquing the unlivable lives created by heteronormative dominance of queer and transgendering men and women, the Butler paradigm around gender and performativity has indeed itself become dominant, marginalising, indeed, if not outlawing, any debate about sexual difference, and certainly any discussions of the feminine. And if we take the case of Lucy Rigaray, for instance, she was initially dismissed, according to Butler and other American thinkers, for the crime of being essentialist, that is, to assume that there might have been some meaning to the feminine in and of itself. Later revisionist readings have released Rigaray from this criminal suspicion of claiming an ontological femininity, and allowing her to be recognized for critical mimesis, i.e. the imitation, which coupled with an unashamedly utopian vision that there is something beyond what we now know, has allowed her to be recognized as someone who offers a vision of the feminine as something which is crucial to complete any rethinking of the ethical. Clearly, for the querying of feminist philosophy in other fields of the heteronormative representation of sexual difference as a binary opposition of masculine and feminine, there is a way in which this maintains an order of subjective positions in which the full variation of gendered and sexual being is repressed in the name of a clear difference of M from F, man from woman. And while the feminine may serve to speak the wounds of certain subjectivities under this regime, it is part of the regime that it is part of the regime that wounds those unable to place themselves firmly in this binary. So when in 1992 I discovered Bracha Ettinger's initiating paper, Matrix and Metamorphosis, I found the conceptual leap beyond both the paradigm of iterative gender through which Butler is seeking to escape the constraints of heteronormative sexual difference, and also a way in which to go beyond the paradigm of sexual difference in Lucy Rigaray, which in fact it remains deeply homophobic and fixated on the notion that sexual difference refers to masculinity and femininity, which, as you know, are Oedipal categories deeply connected with gendering our subjectivities in relation to the triadic structure of mother, father, child, which leads us to be sexed in relation to the opposition between either the M or the F of the big others. Now, Ettinger entered this field from art, as a performance artist and painter working in the shadow of the Holocaust and of the current agonies of the Israeli-Palestinian people, as also having been an 18-year-old during the 1967 Six-Day War and in the army. She also entered it from psychoanalysis itself. Having trained in clinical psychiatry in Israel, she came to the Tavistock in the 1970s to work under R.D. Lang and to study Wilfred Bion. Then she went to Paris, where she was in analysis with Pierre Aulagnier, more of whom in a minute, under the supervision of Françoise Dolto. Françoise Dolto, as you could see, is a French psychoanalyst who also worked in the Lacanian school, but is significant because of two things. First of all, like many women at this particular period, they were looking at the initiating moments of subjectivity, particularly working with children and babies, and she argued that women, children have a language before language, and she developed this into the notion of a body schema, that there is an unconscious body schema. And that's a crucial thing to hold on to for a moment. Now, I also want to talk about Pierre Aulagnier, who is incredibly influential in France and hardly known outside France. Now, Aulagnier was analysed by Jacques Lacan and developed her own distinctive contribution, particularly through working with psychotic patients, and developed this theory of the pictogram and the earliest formations of the subject. I have to give you a quote here. And she came up with this idea of the primal process. So in Freudian psychoanalysis, you have the primary process and the secondary process. The primary process is mostly fantasy. The secondary process is a form of structured sort of linguistic representation. So what Pierre Aulagnier is relevant to us here for is that she introduced the concept from the study of people who aren't yet in language, who are in a sense in a state of crisis of falling out of subjectivity through psychosis, particularly schizophrenia, that she talked about a notion that there are experiences that predate the formation of fantasy as a way of grasping the world. And the the primal process is a representation of psychic experience that predates primary fantasies, and it gives rise to a form of knowing the world, which she calls pictograms. So she's inserted before all of the sort of work on Freud and even Klein and even Melanie and Lacan, this particular space, and I think I want to put it in place because if you can imagine Ettinger in analysis with her, she is suggesting that there are, to try to think about the relationship between the intimations of any kind of relation to the world which will produce a sense of self and otherness that might first not, as Dolto is saying, through this unconscious, this body schema, and Aulagnier is talking about a primal process that does not construe these experiences in terms of an inside and outside, but in terms of a certain kind of relationship to sensation. So I want to give you one more quote here. This is a quote, Aulagnier's uncovering of the primal process of extensive analysis and understanding that shows that human existence consists in prehistory and history of continuous development that occurs in layers that are laid upon each other and are always with interaction in one another. So as I track the formation of the particular psychoanalysis practice of Brach Ettinger, I can also bring in an intimate friendship with Félix Guattari in Paris, who was with Deleuze developing a particular assault on the fundamental Oedipal orthodoxy of classic psychoanalysis with their anti-Oedipal, and she was closely working with him. But she's also fully aware of Laplanche, who was revising Freud's understanding of primary fantasies and returning to the notion of seduction. And she was also enabled by Jacques-Alain Miller to translate the very late seminars of Lacan into Hebrew. So anybody who ever has read any Lacan, anybody here knows this is incredible, to actually read the very late work and translate it, is to put her absolutely inside a form of Lacanian theory which is mostly unfamiliar to people. And in that late theory, Lacan went back on his notion that everything is language and again tried to say there is something between what he called the real, the event that happens, I'm thinking we're talking about trauma, and fantasy. There's the space in subjectivity that Freud didn't analyze and the whole tradition has known, but he began to say we have to work out what happens in the zone between the real of the body, the events that happen to the body, and the beginnings of a sort of a representation of it, which is, of course, when we think about fantasy. Now, all of these reference points leads us not only to the psychoanalysis of psychosis, borderline personalities, but particularly to this question of what is the early threshold? of subjectivity in the zone that Lacan locates between trauma and fantasy, between the real and the imaginary, what others would mark as the enigmatic moment between the body and the psyche. As Joyce McDougall, another very brilliant Paris-based psychoanalyst, states, and here's a beautiful photograph of her just before she died by Bracha Ettinger herself, we know the reverse journey between the psyche and the mind because of hysteria, which is what you see upstairs in the Mad Bad exhibition, and notably Conversion. But, asks McDougall, what do we know of the initial leap? And I quote here, in the earliest attempt to deal with physical pain, frustration, and absence psychically, we have the first mysterious link from body to mind. We know very little about it. Considerably more knowledge has been garnered by psychoanalysis about that still more mysterious leap in the other direction, the leap from mind to body, which underlies hysterical conversion and various inhibitions of bodily functioning. Long before such a complicated psychic creations are absorbed, the baby must first have been seduced to life by his mother. For herein lies the initial movement which stirs the first glimmerings of psychic life. This much we know. The structuring of the psyche is a creative process destined to give each individual his unique identity. It provides the bulwark against psychic loss in traumatic circumstances. Now, drawing all of this together from her own and her own experience, Ettinger introduced a hypothesis that participates in the Guattarian anti-Oedipal tendency without succumbing to the notion that we can just get rid of it. She participates in the Laplanchian return to primal fantasy and seduction, and the enigmatic signifies that the soul, the pre-psychic infant, who has to digest and metabolize stimuli that it has as yet no apparatus to digest and metabolize. She also, however, remains true to Lacan's later work that posited the inevitability of a dimension in subjectivity not ruled by the phallus, which in his late work Lacan said could only be reported on from the lady's side. At the same time, because of phallocentrism, the ladies know nothing of it and cannot report anything of it. So everybody laughs at that because he thinks he's just shutting up the women. He's not. He's just saying we're just all... Okay? But that's why I think art comes to be interesting. That's where Bracha's, Ettinger's leap becomes a double transgression of psychoanalytical orthodoxies and feminist orthodoxies. Firstly, she allowed the possibility that the earliest prehistory of the subject might actually be prenatal. Oh God, pregnancy. Indeed, might it possibly contribute some resources to human subjectivity? Late prenatal receptivity might have some subjectivizing effects on the becoming infant. So let's hypothesize. But only if we redefine pregnancy not as a physiological process associated with an organ, but as something completely different. A mutual, asymmetrical, proto-psychic, aesthetic time-space. Okay, a mutual, asymmetrical, proto-psychic, aesthetic time-space for the becoming infant, and a traumatic return psychological event for the becoming mother in a partnership with alterity. So pregnancy is now understood as a severality characterized by co-emergence and co-affection of unknown others. That doesn't sound like your picture from Mother Care, does it? But why am I going to call it aesthetic? Because it concerns sensing rather than knowing, shifting rather than direct contact, and has no image and has no word, although it might have pictograms. So it might also be rather like Ollagnier's primal, but it's a primal process that gives rise to not two pictograms of absence and presence or mouth and breast, but of proximity and distance, or difference in jointness, or co-affection. Because it is subcognitive, there's no mind to think it, it's nonetheless, as Ollagnier accepts, certain events are affecting and they are sensorially registered as material that might be retrospectively captured later on as a psychic element, a psychic apparatus of person. And what they will be captured at is the sensation of encounter, not of subject and object. Now, this is where we run into trouble. Any reference to maternity arouses already postnatal and psychically inflected associations in the mind of all hearers, because all of you sitting there are Oedipalized subjects. Mothers and motherhood either comes to you as blissful or horrific. Maternal is already endowed with idealizing, almost religious feelings, which is why Julia Kristeva suggested that certain kinds of feminism's overvaluation of the woman, mother, rendered feminism a kind of religion. Or it can be burdened with negative connotations associated with either excessive closeness and suffocation, or of distance, abandonment, and insufficiency, or even, as in the myth of Medea, murderousness. Equally, under the rahocentric regime, the oscillation between attachment to the primary mother and carer and the necessary abjection of the maternal body that produces the differential psychological dispositions in daughters and sons in relation to the post-Oedipal mother places this maternal in a very ambiguous space of either the phallic mother we all long to get back to, or the abject mother that we must absolutely shake her messy, watery, milky, you know, bloody bodiliness off from our fingers. Now, the Kleinian image of the pre-Oedipal mother is ridged with also contradictory fantasies of what we know as the good and bad breast. She's either super, 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 or absolutely this, with all that junk inside of that poison in her breast. And the violence, envy, and rage the helpless baby feels towards the all-powerful maternal mother is projected onto her as a figure who might equally bite or kill or destroy the baby. So, with what ears or fantasies are you hearing what I'm saying about Ettinger's attempt to rethink the matrixial maternal as a resource for an as yet unthought, but not unexperienced, aesthetic, proto-psychic, proto-ethical dimension of subjectivity from the feminine? Does it comfort the abandoned post-Oedipal daughter in you with the image of perpetual closeness to this maternal body that you're fantasizing? Does it fill the phallically identified feminine subject with horror and dread, precisely of such devouring proximity to she whom she has gratefully abjected in her creative embrace of penis envy as a way to have what she wants despite being born a woman? Does it require us to imagine not being, or being a replacement of, in our phallic envy, but living beside a maternal other who actually seduced us into life? Does it trouble the masculine subject's narcissism, so secure in the universalization of his passage to subjectivity and gender identity through the hospitality of the soul signifier, the phallus, that obliterates from all thought any significance of the feminine other as other, not as anything other than that which is defined as not man? Maybe it excites the queer theorist who wishes to think about the big questions of sexuality, subjectivity, and ethics without the dominant model of the heterosexual binary masculine-feminine mummies and daddies, because desire and difference, as we know, does not follow the MF script. Now, the real is trauma. It happens, but we cannot think it. We cannot even imagine it. Trauma happens, present tense, forever. But at the same time, it doesn't happen at all, because it's not integrated into the psyche, except by deferral, by a structure of delay or displacement. Thus, the matrixial event of becoming mother, caused by and dependent on the structure of severality, is traumatic to that subject because it is a secondary, belated instantiation of the primordial event that happened to her before she was a subject, but is happening again to her, who is now already a subject formed by phallic loss and severance. It is therefore profoundly shocking, as is any return of the repressed. And the uncanniness of the becoming mother, or for the becoming mother, is of an extraordinary order. It's not like the return of castration from repression, which was always terrifying, because maybe this memory of the matrixial was either voluptuous or destructive. I want to make sure you have no fantasy in your mind of a cozy bourgeois images of mothers and babies. Becoming all the becoming mothers are to be understood themselves as caught up in strings of many histories of many becomings. They are the sites of not only their own, but their becoming mothers and their becoming mother-mothers' historical proceedings, carrying the transmitted co-effects of earlier generations through this matrixial border linking, while she is transmitting her own psychic shape, as it were, to her new partner in this new severality. If we think of this pregnancy as a durational encounter that allows time to be in this vulnerable, fragilized, traumatic encounter, it is a multiply transgenerational space. And the matrix is therefore structurally and historically traumatic. It is not idyllic or historical. And to give you one example of that, it's one I didn't write about in the book but have written elsewhere, the wonderful novel by Marie Cardinal. It's a novel which begins with a woman who cannot stop bleeding. She's been bleeding for 2 or 3 years when she finally admits herself to a psychiatric hospital thinking something must save her. She has a glimpse while in hospital that if she gives in at this point to the bleeding, she will be mad forever. So with a friend, she connives her escape and makes her way down a narrow alley to a classic Freudian. He sits in silence. Eventually he says to her, "I'm not interested in the blood, tell me about something else." She stops bleeding and begins a journey which ultimately takes her back through her childhood as an Algerian or a French colonial subject born into Algeria to a mother who was in process of divorcing a tubercular husband and finding herself pregnant at the point of separation with a child she did not want, while she herself was grieving for the child she had wanted, who had died a year before. Over the long years of analysis, Marie Cardinal manages to survive as a mother of 2 children, but the journey she writes about in the book is one of the most extraordinary accounts of what it is to go through an analysis. If you've never read it, I recommend it to you. But at the end, she discovers that what her mother had tried to do was to abort her. And if ever you had any suggestions, my interpretation of it, which is her, she effectively, in a sense, her own, as it were, hysterical conversion, the conversion hysteria of her perpetual menstrual bleeding, is perhaps the symptomatic site within herself of that which her mother wished to inflict both on her and therefore also on the child. So the question of the matrixial does not produce a notion of idyllic fusion and symbiosis and happiness. It is a site of extreme vulnerability, which of course has implications in the cases where children are born premature. Now we can keep babies alive for 24 weeks. One wonders what the implications psychically will be of different environments, not bad or worse, but they will be different in relation to this. So Ettinger's matrixial dimension is one prenatal, real, aesthetic, proto-ethical, proto-psychic dimension of human subjectivity, and it's without gender. It's non-gendering. It's queer from its inception, as it occurs and has effects irrespective of the sex of the becoming infant or the gender or sexuality of the later postnatal child. Now, this is where it gets difficult, because it has to be named feminine because it is an effect of the real, in Lacanian terms, sexual specificity of the feminine body. It cannot be imagined or thought apart from the real condition of human becoming. And that condition of human becoming can be defined as a seduction into life that has by definition to be granted its sexual, its non-prohibited, incestuous, and even erotic identity from the feminine. Now, this will produce a non-symmetrical trauma once the real stage of the material matrixial jointness and difference is ended by the event of birth. Now, I'm going to do 2 more rather exhausting things for you before you're finally going to have the reward of actually getting back to why does this relate to art, but I promise you there is a deep logic that's going on here. I'm in charge of deep logic, and you will just need to put some things in place. Now, if I set this up, I want particularly to make clear that mother and baby are phallic positions, right? Because they are subject and object for each other. They're subject to the kinds of fantasies and the kinds of processes that do constitute us in Oedipal subjectivity. So the matrixial is not about motherhood, and it's not about the feminine versus the masculine. It's a different logic. It's a different logic for the ways in which elements of selves and others can relate, which produce a number of different features. So we don't have subjects and objects, the baby saying the mother is the object that will fulfill its drive or whatever. We have a new category called the transject. I'm going to put that aside now because I want you to move on now to postnatally. 3 things will happen that we need to consider once we actually move out of the matrixial way. And the first one is that of maternal shock. And most of what I'm going to quote you now comes from this paper by Bracha Ettinger of 2006. Okay, and there she writes, "The mother, now and I, will never get over that trauma of the corporeal, phantasmatic, and mental coincidence with the other, who is now the infant, who is emerging into the world inside her entrails. From the side of the woman mother as subject, a woman in the unity of her individuality, we must recognize a triple trauma of maternity and pre-maternity. The traumatic proximity to the other during pregnancy, the traumatic regression to a similar archaic sharing of the mother as infant with her own mother, and the traumatic separation from the non-I during birth-giving. The consequences of normal pregnancy, quotation marks, and normal childbirthing, qua normal trauma plus jouissance in terms of the information of transsubjectivity, have not been taken into account by psychoanalytical theory, which for that reason brings forth and further creates traumatic tears in the human matrixia webs. The maternal transgression to symbiosis, which is probably what you have in your mind when I say mothers and babies, something akin to that Renoir painting of a kind of imagined, phantasmatic regression to fusion and mother and baby together, that regression to symbiosis immediately after childbirth, as normal and expected as it may be, is still no less traumatic than a total rejection would be, even though the first kind of regression is beneficial, i.e. you look after your child, and the second is catastrophic, you might reject your child. These are two extreme reactions to the jouissance and trauma of pregnancy. The matrixial transsubjectivity of pregnancy imprints both infant and what I call the archaic mother." And now she's going to use this phrase from Levinas: "The womb-like compassion is a key to access to the other in its nude vulnerability." So she's deriving from this something other than the story we'll get from the Kleinian drama of biting the mother or trying to make up to her by loving her. What we are going to get is a different affect, compassion, in relation to the nude vulnerability of the other. And I see this as the feminine maternal openness to fragilizing self-relinquishment. So out of the trauma arises possible psychic responses, and one is normalized and socially authorized, intense postnatal bonding, which then requires the massive psychic work, which Julia Kristeva has recently described, of the depassioning of the mother. How does the mother actually let the child go after this almost psychotic regression to symbiosis? But the other response is pathological, rejection or inability to reforge bonds, postpartum depression, postpartum psychosis, and even in some cases, infanticide. Survival of the matrixial traces might allow us, and the analysts working with women in this case, to articulate another set of relations in the postnatal, which is what Ettinger is naming compassion, access to the other in a nude vulnerability. And this, of course, is not sacrificial, which is what Levinas and others will see motherhood as. It is an ethical act. It is indeed the basis of ethics. The second is infant shock. And birth is traumatic to the infant, precipitated now into a world of unmediated stimulation from its space of mediated stimulus, border spacing, and co-affection. The world can indeed appear too much, suffocating and englobing, or too little, abandoning, absent, insufficient. And out of this arises what Bracha Ettinger will call three primal fantasies that are unrecognized by psychoanalysis: the fantasies of the devouring mother, the fantasies of the abandoning mother, and the fantasy of the not enough mother. Now, Laplanche interpreted primal fantasies as attempts on the part of the infant to explain the enigmas it encounters in meeting the adult and sexuated world. For Laplanche, sexuality, sexual difference, and origin are the forms of primal fantasies. Where do I come from? Why is there sexuality? Why is there sexual difference? And this gives rise to the fantasies of the primal scene, castration, and sexual... whatever the third one is. Anyway, the matrixial primal fantasies of excess, insufficiency, and abandonment are, however, to be understood as equally existential responses, but to a post-matrixial condition of postnatality. They are for me the very indications of the existence of the prenatal matrixial web itself, which is destroyed in the urgencies of postnatal and intersubjective survival. But the problem is this. In our Western post-Freudian psychotherapeutic theory and clinical atmosphere, a semi-automatic mother-blaming and mother-hating is produced. Unless an obvious trauma is found in real-life history, a ready-made mother monster is offered to the patient while the major cause for almost any anxiety and psychic pain. The prefabricated mother monster ready-made is always in standby readiness as the cause for any infantile suffering arising to consciousness. And the prevalence of the imaginary mother monster ready-made figure testifies, in my view, to a major lacuna in psychoanalytical theory and to the major narcissistic trap of the transferential relationships, due to a systematic disrecognition that particular kinds of recurring phantasmatic and imaginary complaints arising in almost each and every reported case of regressive therapy represent, in fact, primal fantasies and have no other cause. It's not the mother that's doing this, it's the world. So I've argued that these, instead of attributing these feelings to a cause in the real failures of real mothers, so often the case in psychoanalytical practice and even in everyday families where every woman hears the rage of the child directed at their poor human shoulders, as it were, instead of attributing these feelings to real failures of mothering, I would argue that they actually register in phantasmatic form the trauma and violence of postnatal life as it is experienced after the mediated resonance and attunements characteristic of the decidedness of the late prenatal severality. Their occurrence is itself an index of the existence of the matrixian sphere. Thus, the postnatal world is traumatically excessive in its impact on an infant, while also being insufficient and introducing the trauma of isolation and solitude. All dimensions that have meaning precisely because they are the difference from the matrixial domain of shared border spaces, which regulated for the most part forms of co-emergence and shared events. So we must understand that the not-enough mother is a primal fantasy that arises as a reply to the enigmatic question, what is the origin and source of my disharmony with my environment? Thus it joins primal mother fantasies of abandonment and devouring, and sometimes contains them. The primal mother fantasies of organizing painful disattunement are earlier than those that organize the enigma of sexuality and difference. They are also, in a sense, feminine. And primal fantasies are psyche's replies to life's basic enigmas, and they must be recognized as such, so that they do not turn into pipes for channeling unbound aggression specifically towards the mother. Archaic failures in matrixial reattunement are indeed looking for expression and explanation, but are not satisfied by imaginary interpretations, since they correspond not to the mother as object, but to life's disharmony. Only reattunement and compassion, the matrixial border space transference, can heal this wound. Now, I've laid this in because it is so necessary for us not to misunderstand where this particular theory is going. And there are a number of dimensions to it. First of all, that when we come to the fact of responsibility, when we take the proto-ethical and the proto-psychic and the proto-aesthetical into the realm of politics and ethics, there has to be a subject. I have to know that I am helping you. I can't confuse myself with you. So, in Ettinger's theory, the quote that you're going to see here means that actual responsibility is the matrixial is not an alternative to certain moments when we have to organize ourselves phallically, right? We have to know what we're doing. So I think I must have gone past the quotation. No, we are going to get okay. And indeed, responsibility like choice and liberty requires the irreplaceable subject. But at the same time, we have to, and I want to read this bottom quote to you because I think it helps us to work this through a little bit further. The phallic subject with its gaze is unavoidable on certain levels of identity and on many dimensions of reality, and it is an ethical obligation to recognize the phallic gaze, not in the other to begin with, and not by projecting, but inside each subject, because with its negation, denial or projection, gaze operating the subject, it becomes dangerous, paranoia being one of its modes. The phallic subject within each subject in separate identity is both responsible, let's say capable of a gesture of ethical responsibility, but also a potential perpetrator. The perpetrator is not a them, but a potentiality in each of us. And only individual identity can take responsible for direct witnessing and sign it. But in the matrixial stratum happening alongside it, the subject is of a different order, and she produces this concept of witnessing. And it is that concept that I have used to structure my book. What is it to be an art historian writing about art that writes about trauma? What would it be not, in a sense, to take up a certain paranoid position, but and not just to be taking up an ethical disposition towards what is it to write about art that deals with trauma? And in this quotation you have here, this introduction of the H, which keeps witnessing the phallic mode and witnessing the matrixial mode constantly operating, she suggests that witnessing heals by stitching the collapse of the other's capacity to elaborate loss. Where for the artist's transitivity, vulnerability, and oversensitivity to the other and to the cosmos remain open and expanding, new art and healing streams emerge. The eye grows new psychic antennae or senses pointing towards a new trans-sense radius. As compassionate responsibility, as opposed to ethical responsibility, and transitivity of waves are archaic, effective mental methods of accessing knowledge, they function earlier than the ego to support primary survival, but are quasi totally foreclosed when they are taken over by more adaptive survival mechanisms postnatally, and they reappear only at moments of extreme vulnerability. Stepping toward compassion in adulthood is progressively reconnecting with the repressed or foreclosed archaic dimensions of compassion. Now, why is this important? Because we are living in a world of such infinite violence, such infinite loss of the capacity to grasp how we should and could behave to each other, how we could move from an endlessly perpetrating or phallic or scapegoating, playing out, acting out of violence. So how would we mobilize matrixial desire? Expressed, as she says here, by compassionate hospitality and fascinos, to create an invisible aesthetical screen on the level of the real, a screen which through both art and ongoing continual encounters of healing is glimpsed and becomes accessible. It becomes that which is woven and touches me behind the visible and the audible on the borders of the thinkable. This matrixial desire opens up a field of knowledge with the other and in the other, in which the other's knowledge is also recognized within the eye. It can only be reached by a non-defensive self-relinquishment in fascinos and in participating in the subjectivizing occasion offered by the compassionate hospitality of a maternal non-I or the generosity of the artwork as an aesthetical and psycho-ethical environment. Now, she's not talking about art in the sense of anything made and called and sold as art in today's art world. It's what we might call serious art, or what I felt in my book felt with artists that dares to engage with the profoundest issues of the self, of history, and what I've called the interlacing of psychic life and historical life. This raises the question how to write about the art, not conventional art history. It's a way of reading for the way that some artistic practices, some artistic process even, some single works, some lifetimes of making, created subjectivizing occasions in which the relations are those of a hospitality of a maternal other, now experienced through the artwork's generosity as a psycho-ethical environment activated through its specific aesthetic, hence non-cognitive and non-imagistic affectivity. And it is this that has been created through the concepts of fascinos and witnessing. I could explain fascinos in more detail, but I'm sure you'll probably think, oh, God, she's going to stop soon. But I do think it's an important idea. It is not, if you think of Freud saying that the I becomes invested erotically in order to master the world and leads to both the oscillation between wanting to be seen or wanting to see that gives rise to exhibitionism as well as to voyeurism, there is a way in which it always has the kind of power to take, to possess, to control, or simply to reverse itself into that. That is not what we're talking about. We're not talking either about the notion of fascination. It is not to do with that, and I'm just going to show that fascination originates with the fascinum. The fascinum was the idealized phallus, God's phallus, as it were, the divine phallus. And that obviously is pretty deadly when it's sort of exposed. But fascinos involves this process of a prolonged exposure, an openness, a thing rather like the kind of process of pregnancy, a severality which allows you to live beside certain works, to wait on it. You are engaged in a kind of process of being with a work for the purposes not of mastering it or simply ventriloquizing it or getting something out of it, but actually acquiring a certain knowledge that will come when you work with it. And that was what I hoped that I've done. So I've used this occasion not to talk about my books, but they're here in their own reality, as this trace of my fascinos and aesthetic witnessing with a series of artists whose practices reveal the outcome of working on the borders of trauma that were never predictable either in form, process, material, or effect on the artist himself. As I've said, in some cases, the work leads you to a kind of resolution, as I do in the writing about Chantal Akerman's long career that led ultimately to this moment in a film she made called Walking Next to, Out of My Shoelaces Next to an Empty Fridge, or could lead to the disaster of suicide, as in the case of Sarah Kaufman. But it is what I wanted to do in writing the two books was to make plain that I do think matrixial theory offers something to psychoanalysis as a practice which might stop killing women, as it does, to art and art history as a way of understanding what artists do. And it just strikes me as profoundly significant that this theory arose at the intersection of psychoanalysis and art. And I do think, therefore, that out of this there is something that this artist can teach the mind doctors. So thank you for your attention. So if you have any energy left, I'm sure you can take a few moments to think of something that might open up conversation. Any comments rather than questions, because it's maybe that this is nobody understanding you say well.
could you tell us a little bit more about Brahe's, or if you know about her engagement with Freud? What does she have a long or deep history herself of an interest in Freud's ideas?
Oh yeah. I mean, obviously, because you don't come to this without working, with all of this and etc. So I mean, there's an intervention in any of the material, but the main point is none of it gets put aside, right? But what the problem is that we have, which is that we've set ourselves certain theoretical limits, and some of them are called Freud, and some of them are called Klein, and some of them are called Lacan, and then once inside that, analysts have a principle by which to act. Okay? Mm-hmm. Now, obviously, theoretically, all of us are indebted to Freud, because this is the beginning of the possibility of theorizing what psychic life might be. And none of what Freud offers is entirely, I think what I was just trying to stress at the end, which is where Ettinger isn't saying, going down the line with the Deleuzean saying, oh, we're going to get rid of that. Freud, Oedipus doesn't work. Of course, there's got to be a point at which you are constituted, so you know who you are, right? And you know, to some extent, that you are a subject and that you have some kind of, sense of your own sexuality and your own gender. So, okay, it's not that. So we can't simply say we're going to go from this, model of the one to the model of the infinite, right? She's really putting a different kind of sense of the several. Mm. just one in a few. Okay, so that's a specific in relation to that. In relation to Lacan, she has a different intervention, which is to say, he opened a space which he didn't live to take. He knew, and rightly, like both Freud and Lacan said, you know, of themselves, that subjectively they could not be themselves, i.e., masculine subjects of the kind, and really see what they theoretically, or really sort of acknowledge what they theoretically could hypothesize. So there's a wonderful piece in the Little Hans case study where Freud's talking about Little Hans, and he makes this little aside where he says, we must remember, I think it's what it is, we must remember to take the mother's side in this. You know, he just opens that little space. And again, in one of his papers on the uncanny, where he says, two great primal sources of anxiety of the repressed, one is castration and the other is the interuterine fantasy. Well, everybody wipes that one out and they wipe out some, but they're all there lodged in the archive. And you just bring them to the surface and say, what would happen if we literally went with this, we trusted this thing? And I mean, Freud was, I think, so aware that, all the way through that he couldn't grasp the specificity of the feminine subjectivity because he wouldn't go into that place. And there's this beautiful book by Elsa Grubrich-Simitis about Freud's first writings on hysteria and his final writings on Moses. And he says, she says, she's been working actually on the aesthetics of his manuscripts. And he says it's so interesting that the final manuscript's a mess. There's lots of crossings out. It's not this beautiful, perfectly, you know, written in the way that, you know, Freud's, you know, intellect was so extraordinary that he just write these beautiful texts, I mean, obviously through several goes. But the late ones are very, very marked by the trauma because as illness and obviously political persecution, he was being forced into a state of helplessness that he could not bear, which she reads as indicative of his complete inability to enter into, as it were, the space, to take the mother's side, to enter into that space, which obviously psychoanalytically you transferentially you could do that. He was afraid of this, and so he foreclosed in his own thinking, because if he did, he'd have to put himself in the place of the infant. But the picture of the infant we get from Freud is this incredibly dynamic, wanting, how you have, you know, just but it's an image of the infant, right? Which is an infant that is not, and then the alternative is the voluptuous one. That sound is so full, it's so lovely, you know, etc. But the other is always the source or the object for this alternation between pleasure and unpleasure. Whereas what I think Ettinger is saying, okay, all of that is fine, but let's just add attunement, disattunement, and reattunement. Let's just add a kind of erotics of connection, not erotics of make me whole again. Right? So it requires the Freudian and the Lacanian and the Kleinian all to be in place. And they've all, you know, when Klein intervenes and says, no, we've got to map the pre-Oedipal. That's important, but it's still the pre-Oedipal because it's always laying down the grounds for the Oedipal, i.e. castration. So self and other, separation, cleavage, and the fantasy of being made whole again. That's the sort of essence of the Freudian story. But what happens if you add to that something else which might have implications, particularly which we see in art, where we do allow ourselves to be affected by what is not me? Right? It's not just you go in to see art. I mean, even when you make art or when you see it, that you are eating it or spitting it out. You know, the central premise of the psychoanalytic is you either take it in, or consumption, delight, pleasure, etc., or you reject. But you don't do that. You stay with it. You allow a transformation, which, of course, is also a transformation of it. Which is why I use that epigraph at the beginning. You're not just saying, okay, I've got it, now that's mine, or no, I don't like it, etc. You have to enter into a different kind of spacing, and that's what neither Freud nor Lacan nor anybody has dared to sort of theorize. Now, I was writing on the way here, what would happen if we accepted that, said, there's no basis for this. absolutely non-goer, falls outside of psychoanalysis entirely because life, psychic life begins with birth. We're not going to have any of it. The price you'd have to pay is how you would account for all the people whose lives are made, you know, destroyed, particularly the mother-daughter relations, are destroyed by this mother-hating. Mm-hmm. This inability for it to be recognized as anything other than the Kleinian vision or the sort of absented, you know, figure in Freudian psychoanalysis. There's no place for the mother. Remember the famous Dora case study? He opens by saying, I didn't need to ask about the mother. She suffered from housewife psychosis. She wasn't important. To a daughter, you know, to a woman who's going to spend 2 hours standing in front of the Sistine Madonna looking at an image of the sexual mother, the mother. He couldn't accommodate it, etc. And then we have the Kleinian vision, which is a woman struggling to make sense of herself, in sense, in relation to the violence of having an autistic child.
That seems to chime with your the point that you brought up about the bleeding. And then the psychoanalyst says, well, I don't want to hear anymore about bleeding, and the bleeding stopped. Mm-hmm. But in a way, the psychoanalyst is saying, I don't want to hear anymore about the mother. Does the mother stop? Does the mother then...
Well, I, yeah, removed, and that's an interesting... I don't read it quite like that, because I think it's to do with I'm not interested in the symptom.
Okay.
You're holding to the symptom, and somewhere we have to get beyond it. And actually, it's a very interesting study of how you all the different sort of how the symptom, and then there's a screen memory, and ultimately she, in a sense, has to come to terms with the sort of the knowledge, you know, of her mother's, you know, murderousness, and then she has to work her way through that, etc. So I mean, it's I don't think it's the answer, but I think. Many cases, I mean, Winnicott himself does this when he says, he talks, and it's one of the cases that Brache talks about, where Winnicott says, I know, I hate your mother too. Well, I mean, that's, you know, and she says many analysts want to be a better mother. They think you had this awful mother. She didn't feed you, she didn't love you. I'm going to be the good enough mother now. Right? And that's very dangerous. You know, that's to appropriate the space because that's why I think this whole stuff about the, you know, because the sort of, in the Oedipal theory, right, the little, like in Little Hans, he says, you know, my daddy wants to kill me, I'm frightened of him. And the analyst effect is saying, no, your father doesn't want to kill you, that's just a fantasy, dear. He really loves you, right? And by working through that, his fear is allayed and he can recover his father as an object of love. Whereas if the analyst says, yes, I mean, I went to group therapy because I had a very fascinating son, I do have a very fascinating son, but after 5 or 6 weeks of their analysing our family, they said, don't think, you know, you could have become a professor without abandoning your children. Right, well, I mean, I think it is exactly that. That is it. You know, it's got to be a failure of mothering that causes things rather than a structural scenario in which people are caught up. And if you read different relations in the scenario, you can help bring out transformations at different levels. That may be true. I don't think it was. But, you know, it's that instant assumption that you're either not good at, you know, you're either too much or too little. So if you stayed at home, they'd say, your child's suffering from being suffocated. You know, you should have given him more space, okay? It's nothing to do with us. Okay, there obviously are very, when she says there are really psychotic mothers, people who do that. But in ordinary terms, it's got to be understood existentially that we are destitute. We are suddenly confronted postnatally with extraordinary traumatic elements on both sides of this severality out of which life came. And analysis neither looks at either of them. So that's a failure in the analytic side, I think this comes. But in terms of then when we think about why art, certain kinds of art works, it works because it works on this different register of attunement, of reattunement and resonance and board spacing, allowing and the fascinos and all these particular words, which could go back into our analysis so that, you know, when I understand analysis is a kind of witnessing and a kind of fascinance, but not based on the only thing going on being, is the amnesty my mother or my father?
Might does it create a new space for the analyst to consider? Did you get to the stage where you answered your question about, you know, can an artist teach the mind doctor?
Yeah, I think so, because I think in the absence of any recognition, this terrible, and I mean, there are so many cases where young women go into analysis because they have some kind of struggle, right? And they come out hating their mothers, inflicting unspeakable pain on the poor woman who gave life. I don't know, so we say the same here, you know, how often that happens, because you say, you know, I mean, and I think any of us who've been in that situation sees that this is uncontainable, because there's no way that the mother can say, oh, wait a minute, you know. This relationship between my mother, you, my mother, the mother, or whatever, but it's made worse because of what is said in terms of this failure to recognize the primalness of the fantasies about the abandoning, insufficiency, and englobing. They're not to do with mothers, they're to do with the existential condition of the world. Yes?
I want to know more about the arts bit, because you mentioned a few artists, and particularly rich bourgeois. I remember I saw a show in London, probably it was towards the end of life, where she narrates through drawings her experience and trauma, really. And then she talked about how much lucky she was, because she has this kind of sublimation. She used the word sublimation. Mm-hmm. And my question is, what's the difference? I mean, the concept that you presented tonight, the difference between sublimation and this kind of idea of transforming.
I want to say three things very briefly about that. One of the problems with Louise Bourgeois is that she is now associated with having a trauma. Right? And we have to stop that, right? This is an incredibly intelligent woman who, you know, was in analysis, read lots of psychoanalysis. She doesn't have it. We don't have a trauma, right? Trauma inhabits you, okay? You don't know what it is, okay, in one set of concepts, but you may constantly work out its traces, some aspect of it. So I don't want her to be in this having a trauma. She can't narrate a trauma, because I don't think we, you know, she knows, or he, you know, anybody knew exactly what it was. So in my book, I think one of the things that comes up, I read it through the notion of seduction. Expose you precociously to adult sexuality. That's the one, the first thing. The second is bereavement. Right? There's certain things that I pick up in terms of the work there. So it's not a trauma, but these are kind of situations which may or may not be managed by people in different ways. Okay, so then when you get to the question of art, again, with Louise, she's made to be the mad, bad woman, the woman who sort of somehow deals with so-called this trauma, whatever we think it is. And if you can tell a story, it's not a trauma. It's just a bad memory. Right? So, whatever it is. Now, she says about a particularly famous sort of family situation, I didn't know I hated Sadie until I went into analysis. There's another situation of looking for somebody to blame for this kind of primal disattunement. But what I see happening in Louise Bourgeois for me are certain works, and I'm only tracing the genealogy of a certain geometric form, which is an early work that then becomes the spider. I'm only just tracing that, etc. Which I'm interested then in this question of transformation, in which form is the crucial word. You give it a form. Mm-hmm. It's not a sublimation, so that it's translated from one form to another, which is the classic sublimation. Because it has to remain there. But it's... So that's what I was thinking about, this thing about the ash materiality, pigment, you know. Mm-hmm. So she's a sculptor working mathematically, geometrically. There's something to do with space and form. And it's going to hold something within which a certain set of affects can resonate by means not of being translated or cured or hidden or expressed or narrated. So even if you take the very famous thing that Louise Bourgeois wrote in 1882 called Child Abuse, where she makes a sort of piece in art forum, right? You have to understand it aesthetically. It's a fantastically beautiful, you know, word image piece. And there's something, there's a logic to it, where things go, and it's doing something. Right? She doesn't know what it's doing. I don't know what it's doing, but I know for sure it's doing something in those sets of juxtapositions and relations. So it's getting back to that, and then in certain cases, because I'm very interested in the issue of maternal bereavement, I think, you know, that her mother died when she was 21, I think that you don't ever get over that, right? So there's a question of what would be not only the drama with her father's seduction, but what might be the matrixial loss, and a different kind of this endless creating of a thing that is also a space, that's also a shelter, that's also, you know, something, you know, in terms of the spite of why, over and over again, does that so interesting to her? So that's the kind of questions I'm, you know, going through that. And transformation involves the transmit, it's a connecting, and it's a form, and then it has the effect of it becoming a kind of aesthetic that can then object which can do something in culture if we then begin to, in the analytical sense, interpret it, not in the sort of artist of this equals her intention, this is what it's about, but what kind of psychic as well as historical dimensions of life has she found a form to work with and work through. And I think with the drawings you see upstairs, you get the same sense of what is it to sit at night and do those one after the other, after the other, after the other. There's something in the movement, there's something in, you know, if you went to see her, you would sit at this table and she had this very particular kind of gouache, which is an interesting material because it's not as watery as watercolour, it's not as solid as oil paint. You get enough drag on it when you use it, but at the same time you've got fluidity, and it's just done.
Yeah, in my view, when I read this text that she wrote, it was a part of the story, and it, you know, was kind of skating. I thought that because she was able to say, to put it in language, you know, and say this word sublimation, for me it was a kind of resolution, like, because perhaps I read this towards the end of her life, let's say, I work it out, and now I can say it. But it's interesting, this idea that, you know, it's always been there, and it's always been working through.
But that's why in the book, on the chapter on Sarah Kaufman, is that saying something might mean that you encounter what you never knew was the as it were, the traumatic irritant which made all the rest of what you did its symptom. So Sarah Kaufman is an incredibly prolific writer. And the effect of writing this story, which she finally then says, I felt hot. And once she actually comes to that moment of recreating through narrative a scene of seduction of a child who didn't know what that was, she has to write. It just, the whole structure for me, as far as it implodes in a way, and I don't want to, but it does seem curious. 6 months of the publication, she kills herself. So it's, I think what I'm trying to say is that we have a hope that you get better, that you can sublimate, that you can go, and I'm saying you can't, it doesn't happen like that, but you might find transformation or transport, and insofar as we prepare to, as it were, witness certain kinds of, we then are, we ourselves are prepared, in a sense, to take on the new vulnerability of those who dare to confront things that, you know, then of course do come to us in one sense in a mediated form. Right? That you can then find yourself relieved of what you don't want to know or see, but you know you have the affects, which then are, you know, lent or anything, a sort of lent to intensity to certain kinds of
things. Is there weakness in a kind of form of empathy?
Very interesting question. No, that's why there have to be these words. And one of the things that people really, really hate about Brack Ettinger's work is that she just has to create these neologisms all the time. This is affective, but it's no. You have to hold to it, because witness is a testimonial. So one of the great things, one of the major things about, for instance, sexual abuse, rape, or even indeed in the Holocaust, it was an event without a witness. They said there's going to be nobody here to guarantee that when you feel you were abused, that somebody said, yes, he's the perpetrator, she's the perpetrator, and you're the victim. That's a form of psychological torture, right? So an event without a witness. So in many cases, when people give testimony or do speak out of their experiences of abuse or seduction or violence, violation or torture, cruelty, it's the presence, the witness, the someone who's prepared to be there to lend their humanity to this description of being dehumanized that is a restorative. Okay? So we do need witnesses to the testimony. But that's definitely, I'm listening to you. At the same time, this, again, going back to what you were asking about the analytical situation, there's where you're not I and you. You're allowing yourself to hear something else, which is you're hearing with your own antennae. Mm. Right? So that's where, if you listen with the phallic gaze, as it were, the perpetrator in you might say, I'm not having this. Okay, but what is it to actually be prepared to let somebody else's experience become something you will transport or transform? So empathy would not be quite enough. In the analytical sense, Rachel is going to talk about the dangers of empathy. But what you need is empathy with compassion. So she wants to go back to this matrixial thing of what is it to not feel with another or feel for another, but in a sense to hold another's world in all their relations, to be hospitable to it or to be able to imagine. So she actually thinks infants are compassionate. They have the capacity to understand the vulnerability of their others as well. But empathy with compassion, again, in analytical therapeutic terms, if you are just empathetic, right, you can put yourself in the place of the good subject, right? Yeah. Whereas actually you must be responsible for all the other people in the world of this. So one example she had of an Andersand who had been very badly abused as a child, sexual abuse as a child, and was therefore not able to access his sexuality, and went through therapy he became sexual. He wanted to have sex with 12-year-olds. Right? And he came to his elders and said, you know, will you still love me if I do this? Of course, but the difference between saying, of course I'll still love you, is, you know, I'm going to be the good mother, make you feel good about yourself, you know, whatever, is to say, no, I'm also thinking about the 12-year-old. Got to hold these other strings of relations in a much more kind of complex way, because every individual is patterned into these groups. And I think that's where aspects of the therapeutic relationship, when it becomes this replay of the Oedipal family, allows for disfigurings which do not hold everybody in their group. So you might want to be witnessing, not just your understand, but the others and, as it were, others that have to be part and parcel of this. And that's where he's thinking about every one of us is tied in strings to generations, you know, to the parental at least, but also to siblings, to all the others. And when we, you know, classically take the others and out of the family, which is, you know, what it's done, and then you have this mimicry of the family, it can work, but there are dangers which I think Ettinger is saying the psychoanalysts need to take more account of. Because that's not this particular severality is composed of more than one. Any other thoughts or?
She starts off reading him his letters in a way that is quite violent. Towards the end, you hear her voice with a softer tone. And it's almost like, I wonder what the position is as with film piece, for those of you watching or witnessing, with you seeing that, whether that's an act, it can be transferred to the audience, I suppose, asking. Outside of the relationship between the artist and their trauma, how then the audience refigures in.
Very interesting question. What I would say for my own sort of engagement with Ackerman is what I learned from the work I was doing at the end was suddenly I had to rethink all of her earlier work. And I think in that way, the film News From Home, which is the young filmmaker finally gets away from Belgium, goes to New York. She goes back to Europe, and then the second time she goes to New York, she makes this piece in which she reads the letters that her mother wrote to her, which are, Dear Chantal, we miss you, how are you, your father's working, and it has this sort of, it's this endless thing, which is the mother's trauma is being played out. But she doesn't understand it, right? And she's trying to work it through, so there's a certain acting out of this, necessary thing, which is you've got to go to New York if you're going to be a serious filmmaker, you've got to see Apple Store, you've got to do this. At the same time, it is a gesture of, she's too much, I have to get away. There's an unresolved feeling of this claustrophobia, in some sense. She's acting it out, but she's finding a certain form through the process of film, which involves, as you say, the duration by which the doing of it, the impersonation of her mother, she allows you ultimately to hear or to register her compassion for her mother from that, God, she keeps writing his letters and sort of, I'm feeling, she keeps poking my guilt. Dear Chantal, I keep missing you. Do phone home. When are you coming back? Finally, in a sense, the film allows you, but she doesn't understand that, I don't think. And I think she, when she goes on, she does all sorts of films which are always around, but she doesn't know what she's doing, right? Until I think that particular film, suddenly something happened, and in the reading I make of it, involves, she's going to make a commercial film, which has some reference to her mother's life and her mother-daughter relationship. She goes to Belgium to have her assistant film her with her mother, reading a little notebook. Her mother doesn't fully grasp what the notebook is until we get to the point where she realizes, Nelly does, that it's her mother. And her mother was killed in Auschwitz. And this book is the only thing that remains of Sidoni. And then in the book, when Nelly got it back in 1945, she writes, Dear Mother, I wish I'd loved you better. I always loved you and miss you. Then when Chantal Ackerman is 11, she finds the notebook and writes her own message to her mother, as does her sister. And so in the film, that bit with the kisses, it's finally the mother reads silently her inscription, her daughter's inscription. So you suddenly have this kind of thing which contains the unbearable being the only remnant of a lost mother killed abominably. And then this set of kind of compassionate gestures. And at that point, Nelly Ackerman weeps and kisses her daughter. But then that is shown to, I can't remember his name, the wonderful actress who is going to play the mother in the film. And Nelly then watches the filming of that. And then she phones Chantal and she says, I feel better. And Chantal Ackerman writes, is that it? she feels better. And she says, yeah, that's it, but not only that. And it's suddenly, I have the sense that this is a kind of pivotal feeling, which is, what was all her work? It was a search for something that had this, which could be understood as, you know, film about the feminine, the mother in the John Dee line. It could be about mother-daughter, it could be about the history of the Holocaust, it could be all these things, and she knows it's that pressure. And then you suddenly go back and you take her very first film, which is called Saute Ma Vie, which is when she commits suicide in the film. Her first cinematic act is to film herself committing suicide and blowing up the entire thing. It's as if the only way to deal with it is just violent explosion and destruction. And then the rest of the cinematic career is sort of a slow journey back. And the latest film she's made is made of a comrade movie, which is about a father and a daughter. Just trying to make sense of what that movie is. But I had the feeling her work would take a very different direction because something happened in that moment in Belgium. So I think you're right, bringing up the sort of very strange tenor between the sort of Kleinian daughter saying, you know, spit out this mother, get her away, get as far away as possible, as if there's no way to live with her. You know, but ultimately the durational process and the very long bit at the end of the film, which is where she just films the Staten Island ferry leaving.
She leaves the homeland.
What I would suggest to you is not to interpret it as what she's doing. That's the analytical thing, to say this means X. But what is the effect of that duration? That would be fascinating. That is staying with it. Because you don't know what it is and it's going to happen. And for each of us, that might register affectively as unbearable loss or just allowing some kind of distance or just, I don't know. And I mean, lots of people have interpreted that last, I don't know, 10 minutes or whatever. But that's what I'm trying to get at, is where the actual aesthetic formulations, like the primal process, I mean, if you think back over this lecture, I probably thought, God, what have I come this theoretical thing? But we need those terms for something which is affective and very, very close to something that is almost unsayable, unthinkable, but registers as an encounter with something in effect, before it becomes a fantasy of something, of loss or separation or togetherness, and before it becomes a thought. And so much of that kind of work from the 60s and 70s onwards in a certain kind of cinema and a certain kind of conceptual arts, a kind of performance, even in this case a kind of very hybrid kind of art practice, forge new ways to work almost at that space, primal process or a proto-cycle. That's where I think what I'm trying to say is that one could bring the sort of, you know, the art historical stuff, what happened in the 60s and 70s, why do we read art in a certain way, why is it Louis Bourgeois and Lina Shkochkov and Chantal Larkin, etc. Yet, with this very high, sort of arcane kind of psychological theory. But where they meet, you can see, that might be a way, not simply say, you know, Louise Bourgeois had a trauma in her childhood because, you know, or, you know, Chantal Lacan didn't like or didn't like her mother. Something happens when they make the artwork that is in it, that is more than them and the other. That's what I'm trying to get at. Thank you. I think everybody should go home.
So just I'd just like to thank you for giving us a clarity to something that is obviously extremely complex and to bring together, but for us to, allowing us to reflect on new things and ways of feeling or experience or seeing. Thank you, Zola, thank you very much for being here.
Thank you.